Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Denominations can be very good things. They witness to the fact that somebody somewhere actually believed in something at some point in time. Carl Truman has lamented and written on the decline of denominationalism, replaced by the American spirit of individualism and consumerism. Allow me a simple illustration. There's something to the chain store model. Take In-N-Out, for example. Their menu has changed little over the past 75 years, as well as their branding, colors, and for lack of a better word, vibe. They know what they do it really well, and because they've changed so little, you know it too. You don't have to guess when you walk into one of their 400 locations. I wonder what this one is like. If you're lucky enough to live on the West Coast, where majority of the In-N-Out locations are, you probably already know your order. In fact, you're glad they've never changed, one of the few American institutions that haven't. There's continuity in the brand, simplicity in their offering, and excellence in their delivery. At their best, that's what denomination offers. You know what to expect, you know what they believe, and the substance of the house of worship changes little from church to church. Denominations have shared beliefs like a Reformed denomination, which traces their beginnings to the Reformation of the 16th and 17th centuries. These beliefs are written down, documents that are far longer than most modern We Believe or Our Believe sections of a church's website. Anyone in leadership in these churches must sign on to and be examined by these documents, those which summarize the teachings of Scripture and outline various differences from other denominations. Much like our In-N-Out illustration, there's very little room for choice, and that's a good thing. It aids in conformity, which might sound like a dirty word depending on your political affiliation, but I guarantee that you'd rather that than autonomy. You must choose for yourself. When you travel or move or visit another congregation within the same denomination, you need worry little about what you're walking into. In modern American evangelicalism, that's less the norm than the exception. While the exact way the service runs may differ from one congregation to another in a certain denomination, the substance of the service, the beliefs and preaching and songs and theological outlook differ little. Culturally even, they may differ. What they wear, how they speak, their language and accent, illustrations and style of worship, but the substance stays similar. In one denomination, they sing only psalms, and another they baptize babies, or they only baptize adults. And though I differ, some ordain women to the pastoral office, and others ordain only men. Certain theological views are prescribed and set forward as orthodox, and others as heterodox or heretical. But here's the thing. They tell you this. It's made clear. That's why denominations matter. They lay it all out in the open. They're clear about what they believe and what they don't. Yes, there are debates and disagreements, even heated, between various denominations, but at least they know what's being debated or disagreed about. It's not, let's agree to disagree, but this is what we believe. That may sound unnecessarily divisive, but it is clear. In modern evangelicalism, there's a desire to be all things to all people, which becomes, we don't really stand for anything. So why is this important to foreground a discussion about the CREC, Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches? First off, this denomination wasn't founded as another Reformed denomination, though this is what they claim, but as a response to the other denominations. The CREC was formed by three churches in Washington State in the late 90s, who relatively recently came to Reformed convictions, early 90s. They distinguished themselves from the other Reformed denominations under the umbrella of NAPARC, North American Presbyterian Reformed Council, but they did something else uncommon to the Reformed tradition. Above all else, the conformity within the CRC revolves on their liturgy, the form and structure of the worship service. There are shared cultural distinctives across the denomination, ways of interacting with the world for Christ. But there's a broadness to their approach to theological unity, while laudable, that adds layers of discontinuity throughout the denomination. In many ways, there is more cultural conformity between churches than theological, though the cultural project may be cloaked in theological language. It has seemed for a while, and especially so recently, that the CRC was founded because they thought other Reformed denominations lacked a spine. Sure, traditional Reformed denominations had strong theology, but they just didn't do anything. A denomination needs to be strong, and that strength needs a broad enough coalition that theological lines may need to be crossed in order to engage in the battles of our day. The CRC rose to fame during the COVID years, more for what they were against than what they were for. The crossing of theological lines made room for the adherence to certain cultural dogma. All of Christ for all of life became less a theological rally cry, the result of deep confessionalism, but of a cultural battle cry. In essence, they said, the church isn't doing enough. Let's fight. Whether that gets your heart racing to join the battle or makes you cringe, that's not the point of the church. Welcome to episode 9, The Anti-Denomination. Why an episode devoted to a small and obscure denomination, you might ask? What does this have to do with the culture of abuse and Reformed and like-minded denominations and churches? Fair questions. Because this was and is a reaction. You'll often hear from these circles, well, don't you know what time it is? We're at war. It's Christian nationalism or transing kids. I think the decision is clear. We need the denomination that fights and churches that put their muscle where their mouth is. A church that supposedly speaks like the prophets of old, using obscenities, which they didn't, to wake up our culture. America, they say, needs a church with strength, a church that stares the effeminate culture in her face, tells her she's a blank, forces her to submit, and leads her to punishment. I mean, victory. This denomination isn't designed well, because it's made up of parts. Parts from the Presbyterian world, from the Baptists and Anglicans, Episcopalians, and Dutch Reformed. They argue it's like building a super denomination, but I'd wager it's like Dr. Frankenstein crafting a monster, disfigured, but still monster. You let it go, and whoops, it causes destruction, because you didn't realize what you created. So with the help of Jeff Moss and a smattering of clips from Doug Wilson, Rich Lusk, and Uri Brito, the presiding minister, we'll dive deep into the communion of Reformed and Evangelical churches. Let's begin. We begin with the CRC's beginnings. Let's hear from Doug.
CRC stands for Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches. It's gone through a name change over the years. It was Confederation of Reformed Evangelicals, and we changed it to Communion to more accurately reflect what it was we were trying to do. And we made it churches. It was not an association of persons. So it's now the Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches, okay. The CRC. We had a ministry that was starting to thrive here in Moscow and was having an impact. My dad had selected this location because of the universities, University of Idaho, and then Washington State is right across the border in Washington, in Pullman, Washington. And a couple of men who were greatly impacted by the ministry here during their college years went back home, one of them to Bellevue, Washington, and one of them to Wenatchee, Washington. Right. And they wound up pastoring churches there. And they sort of, at the time, our church, Christ Church, was named Community Evangelical Fellowship, CEF. And these men impacted by the ministry started Eastside Evangelical Fellowship in Bellevue and Wenatchee Evangelical Fellowship in Wenatchee. Okay. And somewhere in my doctrinal pilgrimage, I'd come to Presbyterian convictions. Our church was an independent Jesus people type of church, started in 1975.
So Presbyterian plurality of elders primarily?
Is that the plurality of elders and broader association outside the local church.
Yeah.
So I had come to Presbyterian convictions, and we had these two sister church, organic, informal sister churches. And so the idea occurred to me that we ought to associate, and we hammered out a rough constitution and met to hammer out the details and formed this this denomination, this communion, initially with three churches. Okay, I was also, although I'd become Presbyterian in my convictions about church government, I was also suspicious of over-centralization.
Three churches partnered up to begin the Confederation of Reformed and Evangelicals, later the Confederation of Reformed and Evangelical Churches. Maybe you didn't know that. You might have only known them as Communion of Reformed and Evangelical Churches. That's because in the late 2000s and early 2010s, they started catching flack from the South. You could say they had a reason to scoff at the word. Confederate history wasn't kind to non-white people. But that's conspicuously absent from Doug's description after the founding of the Confederation. So what really caused the name change, beyond the tame answer of, well, we're really a communion, not just a confederation? I'll begin by reading off the first paragraph of the CREC's 2011 report, A Message to the World Regarding the CREC Name Change, from Jack Phelps, the then presiding minister. On October 6, 2011, the CREC Church Council voted to change the name of the CREC from the Confederation of Reformed Evangelical Churches to the Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches. This change was a result of a three-year deliberative process within the Confederation, driven by a concern that in some parts of the United States, our name was frequently misconstrued to imply certain cultural connotations that were never intended by our founders or by our churches. They then go on to explain the two reasons why they chose communion. Not why they changed to communion, but why they chose communion. But here's Jeff talking about the meetings and deliberation behind that change.
And Doug wasn't even officially a delegate to the CREC Council that year, but he was asked to speak to the council as they were deliberating this. And so the council, which is made up of two representatives from each presbytery, had him come to speak to them, gave him the floor. And he said, all these people in the South that are talking about the practical limitations of the word confederation and how this word in our name is actively keeping these churches from growing as they could, let's not delay on this anymore. Let's change the name. And once he spoke to that, from all I could tell, that his voice was what turned the tide. And they changed the name from Confederation to Communion. So he still has this interesting role.
Yeah.
Sometimes he's the presiding minister of the whole CREC. Sometimes he's not. But whether he is or not formally in that role, when he speaks, people listen. Or as one CREC pastor once said, when Doug catches a cold, the whole CREC gets pneumonia.
Here's Yuri Brito, current presiding minister of the CREC, answering the same question Doug did about the founding and name change of Confederate to Communion. Notice the similarity in response compared to the CREC report on the same thing.
Initially, In 98, it was formed as a Confederation of Reformed Evangelical Churches, just an alliance of churches. That's essentially what confederation means. And several years later, our council decided, as a way of including our European churches, that one better way of communicating what was happening within the CREC was to change the term confederation to communion. And in that manner, it helped with translational issues, let's put it that way. And so we changed that title to Communion Reformed Evangelical Churches. And so we have churches in Eastern Europe, in Europe. You know, we have a church now in England now, churches in South America. And so that in itself changed around 7-8 years ago.
Yuri Brito was then challenged by Keith Foskey on the York Calvinist podcast about the name change and its links to Southern Confederacy and implied racism.
No, it did play a role in forming this. There were several reasons, but that was one of the roles, because Confederacy is very much identified with the South, and it wasn't exemplifying the universality of our group.
Sure sounds different from the CREC report on the same. A 3-year deliberation about the Confederacy and churches in the South. But you've already heard about racism in the CREC and Christian nationalism on an earlier episode, so let's move on. How is the CREC structured? In Reformed denominations, the polity, which is the structure of the denomination and its governance, how it is run, is relatively straightforward, but complex. The complexity isn't because it's confusing. It's multi-layered and fairly bureaucratic. I've watched and been part of many meetings myself. But this structure, as you heard earlier, is an amalgamation of various forms of other church traditions. You've got a presiding minister who sure sounds like an Episcopal bishop at points and acts like one too. Options on how many offices, elder, deacon, pastor, and the like, each church has, and the role of these meetings, what gets done, and who really has the power. Let's get back to Jeff, who took the minutes, kind of like a court stenographer, for many synods and presbytery meetings.
So that brings me to one of the last questions I have for the CREC, at least polity-wise.
Sure.
Because it sounds like, and I'm sure those listening too are thinking the same thing, it seems, this organizes the wrong way to describe it. It seems confusing. How some of this stuff works,
right?
That there are presbyteries, and yet if you're a Presbyterian in the NAPARC under the NAPARC umbrella, then your pastor is a member of Presbytery, he's not a member of the church. If you're in Dutch Reformed circles or Dutch Reformed is adjacent, he's a member of the local church body, because the presbytery, wouldn't call it that, they call it classes or synods, which are the larger bodies. Mm-hmm. There, he's not a continuing member of that, because those don't exist outside of them actually meeting for assemblies or for consistories or whatever it may be. And also, too, with what you're saying, with the office views that some churches come in with 2 office, some come in with 3 office, some come with 4 office. You're also saying, too, with elders or those who are ordained men within CREC, can hold to varying views on baptism. They can either be
correct
fatal baptism or cradle baptism, so either infant Baptist or believer's Baptist. Am I missing anything, or is this like,
no,
is it?
No, that's exactly how it is. And elders can hold to different views of paedo communion. So ironically,
interesting.
The only thing where there isn't a whole lot of leeway to differ, again, from my experience and from my observation of the CREC, over the past 9 years since I left it myself in 2015, the one thing where there's not a whole lot of leeway, at least to publicly raise objections, is to postmillennial eschatology, where it's pretty much expected that you're going to be postmillennial if you're going to be speaking up in the CREC, because we have this optimistic postmillennial mindset, and that's the way it's often framed. We believe that the gospel is going to fill the earth and transform the earth. And if you don't believe that, then what are you really doing here in the CREC? And it's funny that would be, again, not on paper, but in practice, would be one of the things that holds the denomination together, even where there are differences on baptism and communion and church government. So there's that interesting incongruent situation. But I would say about so many things in the CREC, if I could pull back a little bit.
Yeah.
My observation is that Doug makes it up as he goes along. And that's true about his own personal theological views, that he's come to an amalgam of theological views that, as far as I can tell, nobody else has ever held in the history of the world. He's come up with his own piece together theology that brings in this from this direction and that from that direction.
Yeah.
Paedo communion was, of course, held by the Eastern and Oriental Orthodox traditions for centuries and has always been held by them. It was taught by Rushduni, who interestingly himself had an Armenian or Oriental Orthodox family history. I don't know if that influenced Rushduni to hold to and teach Paedo Communion, but it's an interesting correspondence. But anyway, Doug came to that view, and the CREC has increasingly made that one of its badges of honor. And then on church government, Doug made up this baptismal cooperation agreement that allows men to be ordained and be in leadership who hold to both Baptist and Paedo-Baptist positions, and allowed for a blend of congregational and Presbyterian and Episcopal forms of church government within the same constitution. So the same denomination, the same presbytery at the same time is congregational in some ways, Presbyterian in other ways, Episcopalian in other ways, and has amalgamated all these things in a very idiosyncratic way. And then, of course, the fact that individual congregations can hold to different confessional standards. They can hold to different views of church office, two office, three office, or four office. And all of that exists in this uneasy symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. You've already kind of broached this topic, but I want to press into this a little bit more. So when either Doug or somebody else, maybe higher up in the CREC, describes CREC polity, you tend to hear it as like, oh, like we're on the more inclusive side. We just bring those in who want to come in as long as they believe the core principles, like you said, of postmillennialism, other things. But is it intentional, or is it he kind of brings in other things without great coherence around this?
Yeah. So recently there's been, and I'm following this on Twitter, on X, there's been some back and forth between various CREC pastors about who do we actually want to be as a confederation. So there's been a message that's coming, and I've seen it primarily coming out of Moscow, that we are open to people, particularly people with Calvinistic or Reformed views of salvation.
Yep.
And whether you're Baptist, whether you're Paedo-Baptist, whether you believe in communion upon profession of faith, whether you believe in Paedo-Communion, all are welcome. Come join the CREC. Come move to Moscow. Join Christ Church. Join one of our other churches in Moscow. All are welcome. All are celebrated. All are respected. So there's that message. Mm-hmm. Then there's the message coming from Yuri Brito, who's the current presiding minister of the entire CREC. Presiding minister of council would be his position, technically. And he says the CREC is unquestionably marked by postmillennial eschatology and by Paedo-Baptist practice and by the covenant renewal form of worship. He says you can have other practices and other views and be accepted within the denomination. Just know that those things are our hallmarks, which is a little bit of a different spin than what you're hearing out of some leaders, at least in Moscow currently. And then you've got the other message coming from yet other current CREC pastors, which is if you're not postmillennial, if you're not Paedo-Baptist, if you're not Paedo-Communion, you could be in the CREC, sure, but why would you really want to? Because that's our identity. That's who we are. And so if you're going to join, you can join. No one's going to stop you from being in church membership in one of our congregations. But just know that you'll be in the minority and you won't be in line with the prevailing views that make us who we are. So you've got those three competing messages along that particular spectrum that are variants with each other right now. And it'll be interesting to see which of those wins out.
Yeah. Was this kind of foreseen, or do you think it was, like you said, it was made up as you went along, taking various bits and pieces and flavors from different denominations and putting them into one pie, and then out comes the CREC, although it still sounds like it's still being built. There's not a great unifying personality around it, even though I think, like you said, Moscow wants to be one unifying. I think Uri is somewhere in the southeast in Florida, I think.
Yuri Brito, the current presiding minister, is located in Pensacola.
Okay. Has it ever had like a unifying personality, or has it always been sort of an amalgamation of differing voices?
Well, I could be reductionistic and say Doug Wilson's personal story has been the primary unifying factor for the CRAC over time. And I believe that as the CRAC has grown and a lot of other voices have risen to the top and accumulated more influence of their own, the denomination has become less cohesive and even less stable, because you now have several different visions. You have the CRAC as a political force in trying to raise the profile of a particular brand of Christian nationalism as one of the things proposed as a defining mark of the CRAC. You have liturgy, very ornate liturgy, with a particular look in the vestments and a very specific approach to covenant renewal worship. The vision that comes from James Jordan and Peter Lighthart and even Jeff Myers of the PCA being the thing that would define the CRAC, especially for many in the Southeast along the East Coast, although, of course, it has CRAC congregations that hold to it in other places as well. And so these different visions all developed more or less out of Doug Wilson's initial vision to found a denomination, but they're differentiating themselves more and more. And so Doug initially, you know, he comes up with the baptismal cooperation agreement because he was a Baptist who became a paedo-Baptist pastoring a mostly Baptist church and had to find a way to hold it together. And maybe he had the hope that eventually everybody would become paedo-Baptist. It certainly, that seems to be the direction that things go in the CRAC. That churches that come in as Baptist churches start to pick up more paedo-Baptist families, maybe families from elsewhere in the CRAC that move to this church. And over time, more and more people become convinced of infant baptism. And so there's a trend there. Same thing with paedo communion, that if you came into the CRAC as a more traditional Presbyterian family, you'll baptize your infants, but you want them to profess their faith in an articulate way before they would start receiving the Lord's Supper. Over time, if you're marinating in the CRAC environment, chances are sooner or later, you're likely going to shift to the paedo communion position, because that's where the CRAC is at. And that's the direction that Doug himself went, and that's the direction that all of the social and cultural pressures in the CRAC are oriented that way for most churches, from what I've seen. And, I mean, even Greyfriars was the same thing. It was set up to mirror how Doug got to where he is. And so we read the books that Doug read. First of all, we read, I think, all of the books on the family that Doug and his wife Nancy had written up to that time. So all of the Wilson family books were required reading for Greyfriars when I went through in 2004 to 2009. But we read the Puritans that Doug had read, and we read the commentary on the Westminster Confession that Doug had read. And we read some of the fiction, Jane Austen and even P.G. Woodhouse, that Doug had read and appreciated and enjoyed, and that to Doug Wilson represented a nice overview of the scope of good English literature. And so we were reading that, along with reading through the Bible cover to cover each of the years that we were in Greyfriars. We read the books that Doug had read. We read the books that formed Doug. And so we read over 100 of the books that were important to Doug. And that was essentially our curriculum, Greyfriars.
Was Doug your only professor, teacher? What was Greyfriars like with Doug under Christ Church?
Yeah. So when I went through Greyfriars, again in the mid-2000s, the person that administered Greyfriars on a day-to-day basis was Doug's assistant pastor, Mike Lawyer, who's since died. But Mike was the one that ran things. All of the classes that I took during those years were taught either by Doug or by Mike. And one or the other would be teaching, whether it was a course on systematic theology through the lens of the Westminster Confession, including the exceptions that Doug and Christchurch took to the Westminster Confession of Faith, or whether it was a course on hermeneutics, biblical interpretation, or whether it was a course on homiletics, preaching, or even the course on biblical Greek, either Doug or Mike Lawyer would be teaching those. Of course, they've brought in more faculty since then. The one exception of all the courses I took was biblical Hebrew. And even then, I took it for Grey Friars at New St. Andrew's College. And it was taught by Ben Merkel, mm-hmm. Doug Wilson's son-in-law, who's now the president of New St. Andrew's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So everything was kept pretty tight. Everything was in-house. You had to be a member of Christ Church to go to Grey Friars. Now I think you have to be a member of one of the CREC churches in Moscow. I may be mistaken about that, but I believe that you no longer have to be a member of Christ Church specifically, but you still have to be part of that circle.
How does Doug describe how these work? Let's hear from him on presbyteries and their meetings.
Currently, the CREC has 7 presbyteries. There are about 100 churches in the CREC. There are 7 presbyteries. The presbyteries meet for business once a year, and many of them meet for fellowship and other things at another time of the year. So the presbyteries oftentimes meet twice during the year. The council, which is everybody, meets every third year. Unlike, and this is different from the OPC and the PCA, unlike them, they have a general assembly. And at the General Assembly, it's massive because every church sends 2 delegates to the General Assembly. And so it's a big convention.
Yeah.
What we do is the presbyteries have their meeting, and each presbytery sends 2 delegates to council. Currently with 7 presbyteries, we have 14 delegates at council. And then every third year when the council meets, all the presbyteries meet at the same location at the same time.
Right.
So you've got 7 presbyteries and a council meeting, and it's possible for them to talk to each other. Mm. You know, you could have some sort of communication.
Even denominational meetings, their synods, don't work the same way other Presbyterian and Reformed churches do. The CREC has to be different. And I have to let you know they're different. Here's another difference between the CREC and every other Reformed denomination, their presiding minister, currently Uri Brito. They might claim it's similar to the stated clerk or another leader in Presbyterian Reformed churches, but I can't quite figure out how. So what is it, you might ask? Let's hear from Doug again.
An example would be when I was presiding minister for one term of the council, and I was presiding minister when the Obergefell decision came down.
Gay mirage.
Same-sex mirage. And so I issued a statement on behalf of the CREC condemning this move. And the way it works is the presiding minister of a presbytery or the presiding minister of the council can speak for the denomination.
Mm.
But then what he says is then ratified by the next subsequent meeting of the council or the presbytery.
Right.
That's also not how other denominations work. Seeing a trend? This brings up a big point. Doug's ministerial credentials. His ordination. Where is it? For him to be a presiding minister, shouldn't he have been an ordained minister in the first place? The common narrative is Doug ordained himself in the CREC. At least that's what most people think. And I don't know if Doug cares much about correcting that narrative. The truth? Doug's never been ordained by any church body, as far as anyone knows. Doug is self-ordained. Let's hear from Jeff about the self-ordination, which Doug writes about.
So coming back to the time when the pastor of the church that would become Christ Church left, there were no officers, there was no formal affiliation, but there was also this respect and reverence for Jim Wilson.
Okay. So there's no formal affiliation to EV Free, right?
No, there never was.
Okay.
There never was for Christ Church. But Douglas Wilson, Jim's oldest son, was the worship leader at the congregation in Moscow. He was the man up front with the guitar. And so the way he tells this story, it's in the epilogue of his book, Mother Kirk, that he published years ago. One Sunday, the pastor was gone. There were no officers. He just got into the pulpit, started preaching, and continued to do so. And at a certain point, not too long after that, he announced to the congregation that in the absence of any ordained elders or formal leaders in the congregation, if nobody objected over the next couple of weeks, he was going to assume the office of elder. And at least the way he tells the story, nobody lodged that sort of objection. And so he assumed the office of elder. He proclaimed himself an elder. And that was the only ordination that he has ever received.
Hmm. Yeah, I want to dig into that a little bit more, because I think, and you've probably heard this, there is this common assumption that he's self-ordained, that he's self-ordained himself in the CREC, but that's not true, as from what you're talking about?
I would say that he's self-ordained. I would say that from the same set of facts, Doug would read it one way. And of course, when I went to Moscow to study under him, at some point during that time, fairly early on, I became aware of this story. And I had enough respect for him that I would have bowed to his way of reading that set of events.
Okay.
But looking back at it now, I would no longer say that that constituted an ordination. So the way he talks about it is he's a Presbyterian minister of sorts. He would say that he subscribes to the Westminster Confession of Faith with a stipulated set of objections, which the elders of Christ Church have approved. He describes himself as having received a congregational ordination.
Okay.
But the nature of that congregational ordination, as he himself tells the story, is that there were no ordained people in the church, and he basically gave them an opt-out.
Hmm.
And nobody opted out, and so he proclaimed himself an elder. And so that is a self-ordination. Nobody laid hands on him, as far as I'm aware. Certainly the way he tells the story never includes any such component. There was no congregational call, and I've never been a member of a Baptist church. I have been a member of a couple of churches that had some Baptist ties, but not formally part of Baptist churches. But my understanding, and I've checked this recently with friends of mine that are in the Southern Baptist Convention in other Baptist churches, is that it's customary for a man to receive a call from a congregation to serve as the pastor, to have hands laid on him by representatives of the congregation. And so that constitutes a congregational ordination. Doug Wilson never received anything of that sort.
And now here's Doug on the CREC ordination, of which he himself does not have.
In the PCA, for example, and in the OPC, an ordained pastor is not a member of the local church.
Right.
The ordained pastor is a member of presbytery. Okay, and we don't do that. Every ordained minister has to be a member of the church where he's pastoring.
Right.
And so when we ordain a man, mm-hmm. let's say a man comes out of Greyfriars Hall, which is our ministerial training program here at Christchurch. It's not the only way to do it, but we do that. Let's say a young man comes out of Greyfriars Hall and he wants to be ordained to the ministry. He's referred to presbytery, and presbytery examines him. And if he's a newbie, we have to do two different things. Let's say a man comes to us from the PCA. He's been ordained before. He's been run through that gauntlet. We have a presbyterial exam that's a getting to know you exam.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The character stuff.
Character stuff, and is this a good fit? And do you know about what we're about, and what are you about?
Yeah.
It's a getting to know you. It's not trying to test his Hebrew chops. Okay. But if he's just coming out of ministerial training, presbytery exam is it's a grueling, and it's testing his Greek and Hebrew. It's testing his knowledge of the English Bible. So it takes a couple of hours on the floor. And there's written exams before. There's a committee that oversees. And then there's a final exam on the floor of presbytery.
Yeah.
Now, what happens is, let's say the young man shines, does a great job. What presbytery does is recommends to the local session, we think this person is qualified and well qualified. Yeah. We recommend you ordain him.
Yeah.
But he's then ordained not by presbytery, but by the local church.
He's in submission to that local church.
He's in submission to that local church, mm-hmm. and he is authorized by presbytery, but commissioned and ordained by the local congregation. So that's one of the more unique features of our system.
I know of nothing like this in the Reformed and Presbyterian world. They keep saying this is Reformed and evangelical denomination, but is it? Seems like something they baked up for their own purposes. Another difference, I know I keep saying that, but it's just true, is what non-ordained ministers and ordained ministers can do, which isn't much difference. It seems to me that this was built to allow Doug to minister in the CRAC without ordination. What is it? Let's hear from Jeff.
A point where they take exception that I think would be quite a bit more controversial and that is tied into the history of their church and to Doug Wilson's personal history is where it says in the Westminster Confession that the sacraments, baptism and the Lord's Supper, should be administered by duly ordained elders,
yep.
officers of the church. And they take exception to that.
Mm-hmm.
They say, no, that's not required. Rather, the way that they put it in their exception, which is the official position of Christ Church and of Christ Church's session of elders, is that the sacraments can be administered by anyone under the supervision of elders duly ordained. And that does a few things. That takes away the issue of Doug Wilson not having been ordained in the ordinary way, so that in a sense he has a line to retreat to. He would make the claim that he has a congregational ordination, as I've discussed. But if anyone disputes that, he could still say he's in submission to a session of elders. And so any action he's taken is not his action alone, but it's an action that's authorized by a session of duly ordained elders at Christ Church. Another way that that's convenient for them is that they can have men that have been at Greyfriars for at least a year, because they require at least a year to get your feet under you. They can send them out to preach at other congregations, maybe another CRAC church that doesn't have a pastor, or pastor's on sabbatical, or the pastor's on vacation that weekend. They can send men out to preach who are ministerial students, not by any means ordained, maybe not even with ordination on the near horizon. But the elders meet, make a decision, we're going to commission this man to preach, to celebrate the Lord's Supper, even to perform baptisms, and then he's fully authorized under the rules of Christ Church, even if not under the Westminster Confession. And so that was me.
You have a personal history with this, yeah.
Before I was ever ordained, I preached at quite a number of different churches, even
which is
in
not uncommon
countries.
For NAPAR churches. Sure. You can get licensed in all NAPAR churches, and they'll call it exhort or preach, depends on their terminology. Mm-hmm. But it's not this practice is not uncommon.
But for Christ Church, preaching went closely together with administering sacraments, and it's not as if they saw it as a package deal necessarily. Yeah. But once they sent you out to preach, it was a given that if they approved of you and if a church had a need, the elders would meet and commission you to administer the sacraments. And so you'd be unordained, could even still be unordained for many years. I was commissioned, I believe, in 2006 and was administering the Lord's Supper, performing baptisms, marriages even, and certainly preaching for 8 years. Before I ever got ordained in the CRAC, which eventually happened in February of 2014.
Well, for those who are listening, this is at major variance. Maybe besides paedal communion is one of the biggest differences between the CRAC understanding or exception or whatever you want to call it of the Westminster Confession of Faith, because Presbyterian Reformed churches do not allow a licensed man to administer the sacraments. You can exhort and they will separate that, which is my story. They will separate that unless and until you're ordained, but you can only administer the sacraments as an ordained minister, not as a ruling elder, not as a deacon. And if you're in a Dutch Reformed, not as a elder at all, it's only as a minister of ordained sacrament. So this is one of the big differences between the CREC polity and their interpretation of Westminster Confession of Faith, and the NAEPARC denominations and how we understand the Westminster Confession of Faith or the Three Forms of Unity.
And this leads to their cafeteria approach to the confessions and catechisms of the Reformed world. In order for the system to work, you've got to allow a variation of belief systems, polity, and practice. In Reformed and Presbyterian denominations, of which they claim to belong to, you don't choose a statement of faith, you subscribe to the one already available. If you join the Presbyterian Church of America, you've got the Westminster Standards. If you choose the United Reformed Churches of North America, you've got the Three Forms of Unity. Simple and easy, like In-N-Out. But with the CREC, you must subscribe to one of the historic creeds of the church, and that's a good start. But you choose from one of the 12 historic confessions of the Reformed Church. Sounds good, right? Like they're trying to be inclusive and open theologically. Until you have one person or family move from one church to the next in the same denomination, and they believe completely different things. One church practices paedobaptism, which is baptizing babies, and the other church practices cradle-baptism, baptizing adults. You've got infants you want baptized, but you just joined a cradle-baptist church. What do? You've been convinced the Presbyterian way of doing things for years. You move for a new job or to be closer to family, and a church in the same denomination does things completely differently from what you're used to. See what I mean? Let's hear from Doug on this pick-and-choose approach to confessionalism and how he makes both Baptists and Presbyterians happy.
So, the way the confessions are set up in the CREC, in order for a church to come in, every church is required to adopt into their documents the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, and the Definition of Chalcedon. Mm-hmm. Those are the three mandatory confessions. Yeah.
From the ecumenical council.
Creeds.
Going way back.
So every church holds to those. And then we have an array of reformational confessions that they have to select from. Okay, so each church holds to those three basic ones. And then our church holds to the Westminster Confession, 1646. You can also adopt the American Westminster. You could adopt the Heidelberg Catechism. You could adopt the Synod of the Canons of Dort. You could adopt the London. Here's the quirk. You could adopt the London Baptist Confession, 1689.
Right.
And so you have to pick one of those things. And we've agreed that we're not going to adjudicate doctrinal disputes that arise because of differences between those
creeds,
between those confessions.
And here's Doug describing the problems that crop up when you have this cafeteria approach to confessions.
So if you've got a Westminster church and a London Baptist church, if you're on opposite sides of the country, no blood, no foul.
You're in the same town, right?
But if you're in the same town, the real problem comes up is when a person transfers, they move across the country, and they're a member in good standing in this CREC church, and they wanted to go to another CREC church. And they've got a four-year-old who was baptized and has been taking communion for 3 years.
Right.
Okay. And then they come to a Baptist church.
Yeah.
Right. And the youngest baptized person is 12.
Yeah. Past the age of accountability.
Yeah, of course. What we do, and we're in the middle of sorting this out now, it presents a challenge. But Paul says in Ephesians 4 that we're to labor to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Mm. So that involves, unity involves work. Mm. So we're working on if you have a non-paedo communion church and a paedo communion church, or if you have Paedo Baptist, Credo Baptist, that presents challenges, but we're just committed to working on it. The exhortation of the CREC Constitution is that we remember the law of Christ and we labor for unity, and we've got a sacramental committee, and we've got some sacramental recommendations that we're going to be discussing at this upcoming CREC. It's a challenge,
yeah.
But we're committed to doing it without demanding that people abandon their convictions.
Mm. We're in the middle of sorting this out now. I'm glad they're working on this, but isn't this the sort of thing that's been sorted out? Isn't this why Baptists and Presbyterians worship in different churches and yet united by a common faith? The desire for ecumenicity is commendable, but without a clear stance, it leads to confusion on the local level. Having a confessionally Presbyterian church does not mean you are not united by a common bond, confessing a common faith with your Baptist brothers and sisters. It means you have convictions that are not shared, but the bond is still there. Do Baptists disagree with Presbyterians? Of course. Do the Presbyterians belittle Baptists? Unfortunately, yes. And this may seem unimportant, but the boundaries are drawn wide for ecclesial and Baptistic differences, but they're drawn narrower for issues that have never separated ecclesial bodies, at least not the Reformed. Allow me to read a tweet from the presiding minister of the CREC, Uri Brito, whom you've heard of before and you will hear again after, on what really binds the CREC together. Now, here's his tweet from April 22nd, 2024. And pay attention to what is not emphasized for the unity and what is emphasized for the CREC. The purpose of the CREC is not to be the PCA without Tim Keller or the OPC without DG Hart. We reject third wayism and dualism, but there is much more that comprises who we are. We are a communion of Reformed churches deeply interested in cultural renewal within the church and the home, theology that comes out of our fingertips and a liturgy that enriches God's people with joy. Our confessions, diverse yet unified, reflect our Catholicity, but it's our shared distinctives that truly define us. We acknowledge that these may differ from the trajectory of other Reformed bodies, but they are the pillars of our 130-plus churches. Among them are eschatology, epistemology, and ecclesiology. Our post-millennialism is deeply embedded in our lives. This is more than a preference for historical optimism. Post-millennialism is how we see the Bible moving. It is far from a mere academic discussion. In fact, it would not be easy to function happily in the CREC without that eschatological predisposition. It impacts everything from our teaching, preaching, to our education, interpretation of the times. Our presuppositionalism asserts that we are not ashamed of the Word of God or its language. The language of the Scriptures is the vocabulary of heaven, and we submit to its wisdom in totality. It further gives us confidence in affirming doctrines like six-day creationism, though many consider us Neanderthals. It is nearly impossible to come into the CREC denying that Genesis paradigm. We do not belittle tradition, but restore tradition to its rightful place. The testimony of the church tradition leads us to a high and reverent esteem of the sacred scriptures. Our paedal communion practice is fundamental to our existence as a whole. Without the communing of baptized children, the CREC would fail to offer the grounds for our covenantal theology. Covenant communion is the way we enflesh our theology of children. We affirm that baptized children shall receive all the covenant benefits. We also believe that they are integral members of the body of Christ, without whom worship would be incomplete. While some congregations can function outside the system, they must understand they are co-laboring with an undeniable majority who believe life and table, water and word, bread and wine, worship and participation belong unto them. We are happy to form fraternal relations with many denominations, and we have a growing sense of unity with a host of institutions and denominations who share our conservative political convictions against the insanity of the leftist ideologues. And the goal is to build much more on those in the months and years ahead. While we wish to continue growing, we understand that not every church is a good fit for the CREC. While we cherish the hundreds of inquiries received worldwide and the overwhelming interest in our communion, we also want to grow in a manner that honors who we are without diluting the principles that made us who we are. What animates and propels the CREC forward? It's an optimistic eschatology. Things will look nearer to a Christian utopia than not before Christ comes. A rallying cry around young earth creationism, and a covenantal theology undergirded by child communion. And now my denominational history couldn't compete with the best of them, but I'm pretty certain eschatology, a denial of the scientific enterprise, and the foundation of paedocommunion have never been the constitutional and enlivening basis of any group of congregations on God's green earth. Catholicity, meaning the universal church, in one area means you must exercise exclusivity in others. What do all three of these emphases have in common? What gets the gears of the CREC going and the mouths of their ministers crying, "Curse ye"? It's the culture wars, as Uri Brito lined out in the second to last paragraph, and I'll read it again. And we have a growing sense of unity with a host of institutions and denominations who share our conservative political convictions against the incentist ideologues. The CREC allows disagreements on a host of theological issues, but the moment the conversation turns cultural, that's where they draw the lines. What fires up Uri Brito, the presiding minister? What marks the CREC as different from other denominations, other churches, even within Reformed denominations? It's one word: effeminacy.
Yeah, that's a great question. I've written quite a bit about this, but I think there is a de-emphasizing of the role that men play in local churches. And that plays out, of course, in liberal leftist ways with female officers and that kind of thing. But there's another practical dimension to it, and that is that throughout the world, most congregations they're female-led. In fact, this is a more sort of a subtle observation, but even hymnals and choruses, they are written so that it is appropriate for women to sing and that men can't sing because they're too high in the way they start their pitch and their notes. And so even that is a testament of the feminization of the evangelical church. What we have done in our congregation throughout the CREC is we've worked very hard to reestablish the role of headship in the home among men, because we know that if we pursue men, we conquer not only the men, but we conquer their wives and their children. And so the one of the distinct features you're going to find in our congregation and in others is you're going to hear very strong singing, a kind of a forte, a bold and courageous call to warfare, to live the Christian life, to increase and grow in our piety, to, as the confession says, improve our baptisms. All of that have to stem from the forcefulness and the strength of manhood. And if men don't lead, it'll be very hard for the women to follow. And because we believe that the priesthood is fundamentally a male priesthood, therefore we want to emphasize the presence and the potency of men in worship and in life. So a lot of our emphasis is an encouragement for men to be faithful in their homes so that therefore they will equip themselves to be faithful in the church.
The CREC exists to battle the feminine spirit, especially in the churches throughout the world. They see this spirit principally in the songs sung in the church, which is what they think has led to the exit of men from the institutional church. The CREC exists to prepare the grounds for the culture war, to educate and deploy the men of her congregations to fight the battles of our society. It's odd. What I hear so rarely is the countercultural message of Jesus Christ. He did turn the world upside down, but not by fighting a political battle. He took on himself the sins of his people and gave them his righteousness. And then through and because of that imputed righteousness and the inherent dignity of all people who are created in the image of God, which is everyone without distinction, we fight for just laws for all people. Men don't leave churches because of their effeminacy. They leave because churches aren't doing what churches are commanded to do: preach the gospel, administered the sacraments, and exercised church discipline. If the church became manly, what about the woman? Wouldn't they leave? Well, not in the eyes of the CREC, because they submit to their husbands, whether or not they like it. But there's something else about the CREC I missed. Something deeply embedded in their culture. It's discipline. Not church discipline, but physical discipline. Rod, meet child.
And then, so we welcome fussing, crying babies. But then we have a special room where the sermon and stuff is piped in.
Right.
For babies who are flipping out. So if it's a meltdown.
The ones that need intervention.
That's right. If the baby is just being a kid and a little squirmy, then everybody just, nobody even really notices anymore.
Yeah.
But if the kid's flipping out, then they should be taken out and exhorted in the Lord.
Right.
Exhorted in the Lord is Doug speak for spanked. Every single person we interviewed for this series who grew up in the Series C remembers one thing from the services above all, and that's the sound of children crying. Not that cute fussiness, or the I have to potty crying, and not even the I'm tired and I'm gonna let you know it crying, but the this is physically painful and I'm hurting crying. The CREC is known for fighting the culture war and babies crying from physical pain as a warning to all the little kids in service, as if to say, sit straight and be quiet, or that could be you. With how divergent the CREC is from historic Christian practice and doctrine, the confusing nature of the ecclesiastical government, and the things which unify them against what disunifies them, how on earth have they grown? On March 11th, 2020, COVID was declared a worldwide pandemic. The CREC saw battle lines being drawn and said, we want a piece of that pie. They grew not because of their response to COVID, but their reaction to it. Viral tweets of their defiance were posted or reposted by thousands of people towards the end of 2020, including then-President Donald Trump. The CREC saw their opportunity and pounced.
It is interesting to me that there's been a resurgence of interest in these questions lately. I'm not exactly sure what prompted it. Maybe it's because the CREC is growing and so more and more people are looking into it because more and more people are interested in the CREC. And Brooks, I think you mentioned, I think maybe we talked about this last time too, you know, in the wake of 2020 and COVID and people looking for a denomination that had more fortitude and backbone perhaps than some others, the CREC got some new interest. And so perhaps that has sort of reopened this discussion as people are having to think through these issues again, thinking if I want to move from where I am into a CREC church, I've got to know something about this. And that may be part of it.
The observation is during the clown years, the COVID crazy years, the lockdown years, the masking years and stuff, I was really proud of our churches because overwhelmingly they resisted. So when churches are told you're not essential, shut down, abortion clinics are essential and strip clubs are essential and pot shops are essential, but you're not.
Right.
We have a bunch of ministers in the CREC who said, let us think about it. No, we're just going to. So I was just proud of our people. They really acquitted themselves well. And one of the reasons the CREC is going through a current growth spurt is because a lot of Christians were let down by their leadership. Mm-hmm. They said, man, back in the day, you talked a good game. But then when the crisis happened, everything, it folded like a cheap yard sale card table. Right.
And so it seems that as we are moving beyond those initial 3 years, that there are many of our CREC churches that were consistently, through various ways, flexing our muscles. We were meeting together in many ways. Some took a little bit of time off initially, but by and large, they were consistent throughout in saying, there are habits and virtues and rituals of the Christian faith that we can't afford to not practice.
To relinquish. Yeah.
And that has, produced a level of consistency, stamina, and muscles that in many ways has attracted a lot of people who have come into our congregations, who maybe have seen videos online and said, look, we've heard of you guys for the first time. And we've heard of the culture that's existing here, but that has existed throughout the last 3 years.
And if you don't have strong pastors that are preaching the authority of God from the scriptures and teaching their people that the authority lies in the scriptures and not in the culture or in your leaders, but it's in the scriptures, and we all have to bow to the same standard, then the pews are going to establish the culture. And the culture then establishes your law, because, you know, power arises from the people. And what we ended up with was just a whole bunch of people who were willing to be led by weak leaders. And I think by God's grace, I told Doug this earlier. I think the role that that Doug Wilson played during COVID for so many of us, whether we were Baptists or Presbyterian or Anglican or whatever, he called us back to our confessions.
That was Rich Lusk, Doug Wilson, Yuri Brito, and a new one, Dusty Devers, who is a member of the Oklahoma Senate from the 32nd District, an avowed Christian nationalist, but a Baptist. But remember, Baptists are in, as long as you're a culture warrior. The confessions might lightly guide the CRAC, but they're big tent evangelicalism, even though they'd vehemently disagree with that label. Their polity is confusing, but I think that's for two reasons. One, they don't know what they're doing, and two, it leaves the doors open for interpretation. Sprinkle in elements of Presbyterianism, a little bit of Congregationalism, some Baptist ecclesiology, a dash of Anglicanism, a tablespoon of Episcopalianism, and a pinch of Continental Reformed, among other traditions, and what do you get? A confused mess animated by cultural concerns. Feminism, bad. Masculinity, good. Science is moot. Institutional ties that transcend theological boundaries because there is cultural buy-in. Now, why is it built this way? What are the blueprints for the Series C? I'm not convinced it's for the heralding of the gospel of Jesus Christ, but an agenda. They accuse everyone else of riding the winds of cultural change, but they would never. The irony is, for the culture warrior, they must know where culture is at every moment of every day, and though they may not pay lip service to it, they react to it. So while they may not follow culture wherever it goes, they must in order to fight it. Someone who rides the waves and bucks against it still gets wet. For this to work, you must have the Bible in one hand and the newspaper or Twitter in another. The church shifts focus from the proclamation of the gospel in all cultures and for all cultures to culture made in our own image. You can be brash, you can be crude, and you can abuse. All for the sake of, do you know what time it is? It's time to go to war. I want to thank Jeff Moss for his help with this episode, explaining the ins and outs of CREC polity and governance, and for pointing me in the direction of the Book of Church Order and the many videos of explanation of their structure. In the next episode of Sons of Patriarchy, we dive deep into Doug Wilson and friends' marketing strategies, especially Canon Press and Canon Plus. We'll look into their various conferences, as well as the other institutions, podcasts, and people they partner with to spread the good news of theonomy, patriarchy, and the subjugation of women to men. Cross Politic, Apologia Studios, Fight Laugh Feast, No Quarter November, Sheologians, Alpha Omega Ministries, and all the conferences, ventures, and peoples they've inspired and teamed up with, we're talking about you. Next up, Episode 10. Marketing, or why the ends justify the means. Sons of Patriarchy is brought to you by the administrators of Examining Doug Wilson in Moscow in partnership with Peter Bell. It's written, produced, and edited by Peter Bell. Original music, sound design, and mixing by Aaron Feeney. This series wouldn't be possible without the dozens of abuse survivors whose bravery and vulnerability make it what it is. Every episode was sent to them before being published, and their feedback, edits, encouragement, and eventual approval make this what it is. May your voices be heard far and wide. Thank you.
That's the average number of apps used by many companies. This leads to a lot of context switching that can distract employees and costs your company. Luckily, Grammarly can help. Grammarly's AI works in over 500,000 apps and websites, making it easy for your team to crank out clear, on-brand emails, documents, messages, and more. In just one click, they can go from blank page to first draft, all without leaving the page they're on. Grammarly has 15 years of experience building effective, secure AI that can be implemented in days with minimal IT overhead. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences, whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon. Join 70,000 teams who save an average of $5,000 per employee per year using Grammarly. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise Ready AI.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.